Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. German investigators say the teenage gunman who killed 9 people Friday night in the Bavarian state capital of Munich received psychiatric treatment and planned the mass shooting for more than a year. The 18-year-old, identified only as David S., received inpatient treatment in 2015 for 2 months before getting outpatient care, according to Thomas Steinkraus-Koch, a spokesman for the Munich prosecutor's office. In addition to suffering from depression, the suspect had fears of contact with others, Steinkraus-Koch said at a Sunday news conference. The shooter, who killed himself after the attack, did not target specific people, nor is there evidence that the shootings were politically motivated, according to Steinkraus-Koch. The International Olympic Committee has decided not to ban all Russian teams from competing in next month's Rio Olympics over allegations of an elaborate doping scheme. The announcement came after an IOC meeting on Sunday. The IOC said it is up to individual sports federations to determine whether to clear Russian athletes for the Olympics. A recent World Anti-Doping Agency report cited widespread state-sponsored doping by Russian athletes at the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, and called for the IOC to ban all Russian athletes and officials from the Summer Games in Brazil. Lead WADA investigator Richard McLaren said that evidence shows a Moscow laboratory operated for the protection of doped Russian athletes within a state-dictated fail-safe system. This is VOA News. A British-based human rights group says Syrian government airstrikes struck 5 makeshift hospitals Saturday in rebel-held areas, killing 1 infant and jeopardizing medical care for more than 200,000 civilians in rebel-held areas. The Observatory for Human Rights said the airstrikes disabled 4 clinics in the provincial capital of Aleppo and one in Atareb, just west of the city. Syrian government and allied forces last week surrounded rebel-held sections of Aleppo, which had been contested for 4 years. The siege has reportedly created food shortages for residents in those rebel-held areas. Afghanistan is marking a national day of mourning on the day after a bomb attack in Kabul killed at least 80 people and wounded more than 200 others during a peaceful protest rally. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for Saturday's deadly attack. An Afghan Interior Ministry statement says 3 suicide bombers attacked demonstrators. U.S. Democrats gathered Sunday for the National Convention, set to acclaim former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as the party's 2016 presidential nominee, the first time a major U.S. political party is picking a woman as its standard bearer. The convention is opening Monday in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, known as the City of Brotherly Love. Clinton is headed to the party's quadrennial convention after naming Virginia Senator Tim Kaine as her vice presidential running mate. Clinton told cheering supporters in Miami Saturday that Kaine is everything that Donald Trump and his Republican running mate Mike Pence are not, ready to become president if she were to die in office. Kaine also criticized Trump.
What does Donald Trump say about these great Americans, these 2 millions? He repeatedly calls the American military, quote, a disaster. And just this week, Donald Trump said that as president, he'd consider turning America's back on our decades-old commitments to our allies.
Trump has called for building a wall on the U.S.-Mexican border to thwart the stream of undocumented migrants from entering the country. A new Associated Press GFK poll says more and more Americans are in favor of tougher gun laws, but are pessimistic that lawmakers will do anything soon to bring about changes. Nearly 2/3 of the respondents support stricter gun laws, while most favor nationwide bans on the sale of semi-automatic assault weapons. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
Call on President Al-Bashir not to use General Taban or General Taban to use him to dismantle the peace agreement.
The South Sudanese President Salva Kiir urged not to violate the latest peace accord.
We would therefore suggest for your consideration as we launch the African passport that we agree to create conditions in the member states to issue the passport to their citizens.
The African Union launches an electronic passport.
Le groupe d'autodéfense Gatia dans l'après-midi.
We were attacked by Gatia fighters who entered the city on 20 pickups. They opened fire at the CMA checkpoint, he said.
And tensions build in Mali's northern city of Kidal despite a power-sharing agreement. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Sudanese First Vice President Dr. Riek Machar has called on President Salva Kiir not to violate a peace accord signed last year by recognizing and confirming Taban Deng-Gai as his replacement. Effort to replace Machar came after President Kiir's 48-hour ultimatum expired on Saturday. James Gadet, DAC spokesman for Machar, told me that the nomination of Mr. Guy as the first vice president could scuttle the implementation of the peace process and create unnecessary discomfort and tension.
This is what the first vice president, Dr. Riek Machar, has said, that appointing General Taban Deng-Gai as acting first vice president would be a violation of the peace agreement, and this should not happen. And he called on President Salva Kiir not to use General Taban or for General Taban to use him to dismantle the peace agreement. And this is a violation also because in the peace agreement, if the first vice president is away for any reason, he's the one to delegate a person to act on his behalf. And this is just a normal procedure. It will not involve appointment and is wearing in by the new acting official. So, in short, it is a violation of the peace agreement. And we hope President Salva Kiir will not appoint him to violate the peace agreement.
Now, but the president needs a partner from the SPLM-IO to work with. Dr. Riek Machar has gone incommunicado following the recent clashes. So who is he supposed to work with?
First Vice President has been in communication with the leadership of the SPLM-IO, and he has made his position clear that he wants to return to Juba as soon as a third force is deployed in Juba to separate his forces from the forces of President Salva Kiir. And this is because President Salva Kiir is not in control of his forces. If the first vice president comes back to Juba with his forces can be attacked by the forces loyal to President Salva Kiir, and fighting can resume. Because he wants to avoid this, he wants the third party force to be deployed first, so that he can appear in Juba immediately. So, and this is what President Salva Kiir should have done. He should have accepted the decision by the IGAD, by the African Union, to send a third party force. So that once this is done, his first vice president, Dr. Riek Machar, can soon return to Juba, and he would have a partner to work with. And if he was to need a partner to work with, the process was not to make General Taban Deng-Gai impose himself as acting first vice president. He would have contacted the first vice president. If there is need for somebody to act on his behalf, the first vice president would have been the one to delegate somebody from his officials. In Juba, his deputy is in Juba, General Alfred Ladugore, and his secretary general of his party was also there in Juba, Dr. Diomaso. So he would have delegated somebody from this if there was need.
Supporters of the president are saying that it appears that Dr. Riek Machar is holding the entire country to ransom, particularly when it comes to the peace process, because he has gone, he is not communicating with the president to see the next step forward. A meeting the president called, he has refused to attend, and this is causing unease, not only in Juba, but across the country. What do you say to that?
Well, anybody arguing like that would have been somebody who did not know what happened at the palace and the days following the clashes at the palace. Dr. Machar did not leave Juba, voluntarily. He was forced out because his forces were fought for 4 days, and he was kicked out from his base. So he fled for his life. And if he's to come back to Juba, his safety should be granted. So it was not his fault that he left Juba. He was forced out of Juba. And he's saying, yes, I'm coming back to Juba, but please let my safety and the safety of my people, and also of the people of South Sudan in general, be granted. Because the people who were killed in Juba were not even soldiers alone. It included so many civilians who were killed. So the third force, which is supposed to come, is not only even to protect him, is to protect the whole leadership, is to protect the officials of the government, is to protect the citizens of South Sudan living in Juba and beyond.
Information Minister Michael Makuei said on Friday that the recent clashes was as a result of a failed or attempted coup. Did Dr. Riek Machar and his troops attempt to overthrow President Kiir?
Nobody will buy that. I think it seems like we have leaders who can just say anything without thinking over it first. Or maybe they don't know what the real military coup is. So that whenever something happens, and although it is their forces who started the shooting, they call it a coup. They like the word coup. If it was a coup, I think it was the government or the force loyal to President Salva Kiir who attempted a coup, because they were the ones who fired the first bullet at our forces. So if there was a coup, I think it was President Salva Kiir's side that was making a coup against itself.
James Gadet Dak is the spokesman for the South Sudanese First Vice President, Dr. Riek Machar. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The African Union launched the African Passport at its recent summit in Rwanda. The idea is to allow better movement of people to stimulate African economies, but details of who will get the passport and what the benefits are still need to be worked out. For VOA, Nick Long reports from the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
Outgoing AU Commission Chairperson Kuzazana Dlamini Zuma gave the first two passports to the African Union Chairman and Chadian President Idriss Deby and to her host, the President of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. She told heads of state there have been overwhelming requests for the passport from many of their citizens.
So we would therefore suggest for your consideration as we launch the African passport today that we agree to create conditions in the member states to issue the passport to their citizens within their national policies as and when they are ready.
The AU's deputy chairperson, Erastus Mwensha, told media that no member state has opposed the passport proposal, but the AU's Trade and Industry Commissioner, Fatima Haramachil, said a few member states don't recognise it. Who gets the passport will depend on each government, Haramachil explained.
They can decide to give it to, you know, good business people that they think that, you know, can, you know, invest all across the continent and so forth. But the ultimate goal, as I said, is really to make sure that, you know, everybody move living.
One interested businessman is Kenyan Kenfield Griffith. His company, M Survey, has done a mobile opinion poll of 167 Kenyans that found 88% approve of the passport.
I mean, it'll be very useful for me, for instance, whereas we're trying to scale across the continent. It may expedite visa processes. It could be a way of having that primary information already on that person. So when, you know, they show their Africa Union passport, you know, that expedites the process of getting the visas because they're already in the system.
Another businessman, Zimbabwean Alvin Musengesi, hopes the passport will effectively become an AU work permit.
I hope that the AU passport turns into something like an EU passport, so that if I decide that I want to, set up a business and look at a certain region, to optimize my business operations I can set up without any complications.
There are technical challenges ahead for some countries to issue the passport, and immigration is a major concern for many. Judging by social media, a minority of Africans disapprove of the passport, many are skeptical they will ever get one, and many see the initiative as a step in the right direction. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
Tensions have been building for months in Mali's northern city of Kidal, despite a power-sharing agreement between two warring factions, the pro-government platform and the separatist CMA. The stalemate broke down on Thursday as fighting erupted inside the city. For VOA, Catherine Ahoya reports from the Malian capital, Bamako.
All afternoon and into the evening, the population of Kidal hunkered down in their homes, waiting for the clashes raging at their doorsteps to subside. They were fighting inside town, next to my house. I could hear the cartridges bouncing off the street. The fighting lasted for hours, says Mohamed Al-Baghsati, a former official in Kidal, reached by phone. The conflict in Mali was supposed to be over. Last year, the northern separatist rebels and the southern government signed a peace agreement that allowed for the fighting factions to be disarmed and reintegrated into the army. Authorities who fled Kidal when rebels and Islamist militants occupied the city in 2012 would return under power-sharing agreement with the platform loyal to the Bamako government and the coordination of movements of the Al-Sawad, or CMA, which currently controls the city. But mutual mistrust and failure to agree on implementation of the accord has stalled the process. On Thursday, fighters of the Gatia, an ethnic Tuareg militia that is part of the platform, arrived at the checkpoint guarded by CMA members just north of the city. It's still not clear who opened fire. Some reports say the CMA and the HUA, the High Council for United Asawad, manning the checkpoint, refused to let the Gatia pass. CMA spokesperson Almu Ag Mohammed says CMA fighters fired in self-defense.
Le groupe d'autodéfense Gatia dans l'après-midi.
We were attacked by Gatia fighters who entered the city on 20 pickups. They opened fire at the CMA checkpoint, he said. Four Gatia fighters were reported killed. Tensions have been building for months between the two armed factions over the management of the city. Ag Mohammed had just returned from Niger's capital, Niamey, where the two entities had reached a deal to share administrative responsibilities. All military operations, including securing the town, would include both parties. Hopes were that the new agreement would speed up implementation of the peace accord.
On a accepté le partage du dernier fief qui nous restait, qui restait sous notre contrôle de la pluie.
We made large sacrifices, giving up power in Kidal, the last town under our control. The platform didn't respect this. In my opinion, there is no longer a peace agreement, he said. Ag Mohammed said five CMA members were killed in Thursday's fighting. Ag Balzadi said civilians were injured but would not give any numbers. The local health clinic worked through the night treating wounded. On Friday, platform fighters retreated to outside Kidal, although sporadic gunfire could still be heard in the city. The situation remains tense in Kidal and throughout the region. Deadly skirmishes have continued to erupt across the north since the peace agreement was signed last year. The government has called for a ceasefire.
J'espère que ça ne va pas beaucoup affecter. Certainement, ça va retarder le fait que les armes parlent encore.
No authorities can operate under current situation of intimidation. I hope the situation will calm down and the parties will allow for the process to continue, says Mohamed Aguinay, the secretary of Mali's Peace and Reconciliation Committee. Many residents of Kidal say the politics behind the recent bloodshed are confusing and beside the point. They are simply frustrated with the government that they believe have repeatedly failed to secure peace and stability for its people. Katrina Heyer for VOA News, Bamako.
The International Organization for Migration reports at least 19 Ethiopians have been found dead from suffocation in a containerized truck in Zambia. The victims were among 95 Ethiopians being smuggled from Tanzania into Zambia earlier last week. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration reports the deaths occurred as the victims were being transported by a suspected trafficking syndicate in Chembe District in Luapula province of Zambia. It says they were crammed into the truck, which was carrying bags of beans and groundnuts. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says data on migrant deaths in this region is unreliable. He says the media rarely reports on this lethal, illegal smuggler's trade, so it is hard to know how many migrants lose their lives while transiting through Zambia to South Africa. He tells VOA this particular incident was widely reported in the Zambian media. This because pedestrians heard pounding from inside the containerized truck while stopped at a checkpoint and alerted the authorities. He says authorities found at least 19 dead migrants when they opened the container.
There were almost 100 in the container. You know, happily, most of them survived, but you can just imagine if they hadn't heard the pounding, what could have happened an hour later.
Millman says 76 survivors, including 18 children, are being transferred to a protective shelter run by the IOM. He says migrants routinely die while being trafficked, but this incident represents the largest number of known migrant deaths.
There have been some amazing horrifying cases in that route in the past. I think it was last year or 2 years ago, there was an incident of drowned migrants who were being seen eaten by alligators or crocodiles. So we know it's a really tough migrant route, and some of the casualties have been horrific, but we hadn't seen a container truck with suffocation like this before.
IOM reports a recent rise in the number of irregular migrants, particularly from the Horn of Africa entering Zambia. It says irregular migrants are detained and put in prisons. It says most of those taking this smuggler's route are Ethiopians, but other nationalities include Somalia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Zimbabwe. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A long-term study in Kenya has shown that organic farming generates comparable yields to conventional methods and also produces more income and health benefits for farmers. Findings from the 10-year-old study conducted in Thika and Chuka sub-counties in the East African nation dispel the widely held belief that organic agriculture needs more space to achieve comparable yields than conventional agriculture. For VOA, Ruben Chiama reports from Chuka, Kenya.
The survey, which began in 2007, was carried out by the Swiss-based Research Institute of Organic Agriculture in collaboration with local partners. It involved field trials conducted on two locations in Kenya's Central Islands. The study showed that the yields of organically grown maize are similar to those produced by the high input systems of commercial large-scale farming. Dr. Noah Adamti is the project's coordinator.
At the end of 6 years, we have seen that comparing the conventional system to that of organic system, yield are similar after the third year onwards in the organic system. Due to the high yield produce from organic, although it is not significantly different from conventional, so we say similar, but due to the high yield over time, this yield was able to offset the higher cost and therefore give similar profit margin to both conventional and organic system.
Organic agriculture tends to have low input costs and hence higher prices on the markets. As a result, incomes for organic farmers start to be higher after 5 years. Researchers say in the sixth year, incomes are 53% higher than the first year. Parallel studies carried out in India and Bolivia on the production of cotton and coffee had similar positive results for organic methods. But Dr. Adamti says a lot needs to be done to promote sustainable farming practices, especially among the smallholder farmers in Africa.
The message I'm giving to smallholder farmers in Africa is that there is the organic farming, be it in the low input need to be improved if they want to make more profit and also leave the land for future generation. And therefore, they need to do extra effort in the management practices to ensure that the labor input gives an equivalent output.
David Amudavi, director of the Nairobi-based BioVision Africa Trust, says the findings confirm his organization's approach of developing locally adapted agricultural practices for sustainable farming.
The work that you have done is quite indicative, it's quite promising, that yes, organic agriculture is not a system that should be ignored. This work also supports a lot, a very important initiative, the Continental Initiative we refer to as the Ecological Organic Agriculture. It's at the moment being implemented in the 8 countries, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and Ethiopia, in Eastern Africa, and in West Africa, Benin, Senegal, Mali, and Nigeria. The health of our soils determines largely the future of us. If we can't nourish our soils, our future is likely to be doomed.
He says their work has proved that organic agriculture contributed to increased productivity as well as improved soil fertility management. The primary aims of organic farming are to cultivate the land and raise crops in such a way as to keep the soil alive and in good health by use of organic matter such as crop, animal and farm waste. They are combined with beneficial microbes to release nutrients to crops for increased sustainable production in an eco-friendly, pollution-free environment. But despite the huge benefits, smallholder farmers across Africa have been slow to adopt organic methods. Dr. Anne Muriuki of the Kenya Agricultural and Livestock Research Organization says the ultimate goal is to support the development of policies and strategies that foster the adoption of sustainable land use practices.
The organic sector has been growing very rapidly, but even that rapid is not rapid enough. That is why it's not being felt. There are a number of issues that have caused that delay, and now that we are showing that it can work, and we hope this experiment will continue to its conclusion, and the trend that we have begun to see will actually be strengthened. The other issue we have is that we lack an organic agriculture policy. When there's a policy of government that everything can nest on, then the government can push things in that area. We need an organic policy in place. It's kind of being put together somewhere, but we need to do that even more.
According to the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, at least 80% of Africa's population depends on agriculture as their primary source of livelihood. The sector has also provided employment to some 70% of the people in sub-Saharan Africa. Researchers say organic farming builds on some of the traditional methods used by farmers, and some say is the cheapest and most affordable way for families to improve food production. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Next on Let's Talk, men in relationships. What should they do to keep them going and flourish? Join hosts Sande Shomari and his guests discussing men in relationships. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Street Talk Africa. Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the Democratic National Convention and what a Hillary Clinton presidency could mean for Africa. Tune in to Street Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the Under-20 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. Nigeria, the world's Under-17 champions, failed to reach next year's Under-20 Africa Cup of Nations in Zambia, falling to a shock 3-4 home defeat to Sudan, who sealed a farmer's qualification. Nigeria hosted Sudan in Lagos, leading 2-1 from the first leg, but Sudan, who had the man sent off, came from behind to level the tie 5-5 overall and progress on away goals. Senegal qualified on Friday after eliminating Ghana, and South Africa and Egypt also went through. Nigeria, who have enjoyed much success in youth competitions, both in Africa and globally, went into the return leg of their qualifier against Sudan as favorites to win. Not only did they hold the 2-1 advantage from the first leg, they also had 15 members of Nigeria's triumphant Under-17 World Cup winning side from Chile 2015 in their squad, including the top scorer from that tournament. Another country missing from Zambia 2017 will be Ghana, who fell to a 3-2 aggregate defeat to Senegal on Friday. Ghana are the only African team to have won the Under-20 World Cup, lifting the trophy in 2009 with a penalties victory over Brazil in the final in Egypt. South Africa will also be at the finals after a 3-0 win over Lesotho on Saturday, winning 5-0 on aggregate. Also on Saturday, Egypt won 4-0 away to Angola to book their place in Zambia. The victory gave Egypt a 5-0 aggregate win. On Sunday, Guinea hosts the Gambia and Burkina Faso travel to play Mali. Both those games are goalless after the first leg. Cameroon hold a 3-0 advantage over Libya, a game which is being played in Tunisia on security grounds. In total, 7 teams will join host Zambia at the finals next year. In athletics, Mo Farah ran the fastest 5,000 meters of 2016 at Stormed Victory in his last race before the Rio Olympics at the Anniversary Games in London. The 33-year-old totally dominated on the same track, where he won 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters Olympic gold in 2012, crossing the line in 12 minutes, 59.29 seconds. Fellow Briton Andrew Bachat was second, more than 15 seconds slower, with American Bernard Lagat third. Farah, running in his first competitive 5,000-meter race of the year, was one of five final-day British wins as athletes intensified their preparations for Rio Games, which get underway on August 5th. Meanwhile, Usain Bolt proved his fitness before next month's Olympics as he dominated the men's 200 meters at the Anniversary Games in London's Olympic Stadium and says he's getting there in his preparation for Rio. The 29-year Bolt clocked 19.89 seconds in his first appearance since pulling out of the Jamaican trials. Bolt won gold in both the 100 meters and 200 meters at the London and Beijing Olympics and will defend both titles in Rio next month. At the Olympic Stadium on Friday night, Bolt finished 0.15 seconds ahead of Panama's Alonso Edward in second, with Britain's Commonwealth silver medalist Adam Gemili third. The fastest 200 meters time of the year is 19.74 by U.S. sprinter LaShawn Merritt, while Bolt's world record set in 2009 is 19.19. Finally, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has signed a new main sponsor for its top club and national team competitions for the next 8 years. The new deal with French oil and gas company Total will begin with the 2017 African Cup of Nations finals in Gabon. The value of the deal has not yet been revealed. Total will be headline sponsors of the following competitions: the Africa Cup of Nations, the African Champions League, the African Nations Champions CHAN, the Confederation Cup, the Under-23 Cup of Nations, the Super Cup, the Under-20 Africa Cup of Nations, the Women Africa Cup of Nations, the Under-17 Africa Cup of Nations, and the Futsal Africa Cup of Nations. Mobile phone company Orange, whose deal ends this year, has been headline sponsor of these 10 competitions. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
One wish, just one wish. Now I'm rocking. someone you know that.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightland Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In the dark and turbulent early days of the Second World War, Britain's wartime Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, pondered what would be the behavior of Russia towards Germany. Specifically, he was wondering what would Joseph Stalin, then leader of Russia, do in those turbulent days. Fast forward to July 2016, particularly after the conclusion of the Republican convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Many Americans, as well as many in the wider international community, are wondering what would be the actual behavior of the Republican nominee, Donald J. Trump, should he become the president of the United States. Judging from the reporting in the African press and comments by leading African politicians and statesmen, Africans are also conflicted. On the one hand, Donald Trump has said many things which many Africans could easily embrace. For example, he has said that he is totally opposed to the concept of regime change, something which many Africans have been saying over the years. And in this regard, Mr. Trump has condemned the intervention in Libya, which resulted in the overthrow and death of Colonel Gaddafi, again something which the African Union at the time condemned. Furthermore, Donald Trump has said that he does not support the practice of the United States or the Western governments in putting pressure on dictatorial leaders outside of the United States. His argument is that the Americans have so much trouble in the United States and they have no moral authority to tell others how they should behave. Again, this is something which many Africans have been saying for many, many years. Then Africans are also pleased that he has talked about reconciliation between the United States and Russia under President Putin, and also, surprising to many Americans, with the leader of North Korea. So while the Africans have seen all of this and are pleased by what Donald Trump has said, they are opposed to many other things he has outlined. And they would never forget that Donald Trump was the father of the so-called birther movement in the United States. It was he who said that President Barack Obama was not born in the United States, that he was born in Kenya, and that his mother smuggled him into the United States. This was the first attempt to delegitimize President Obama, and this made him very prominent, not only within the Republican Party, in many right-wing groups. Secondly, many Africans do not support a strong advocate of action against immigrants and other minorities. Furthermore, they are not sure whether Donald Trump will be of any particular interest to Africa because he has not shown similar interest to African Americans in the United States. So this is the dilemma that Africans face towards the new Republican nominee for presidency. And it is very clear that when you compare Donald Trump, you are faced with the same dilemma that Churchill faced in October 1939 when he commented about the behavior of Russia at the outset of the Second World War. Two things are worth saying. One can say, one, that for Donald Trump, all is gaze at once. Or, to accept Churchill's formulation, Donald Trump is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if you neglect the pot, it boils over and extinguishes the fire. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. is providing nearly $800,000 in aid to help Mongolians mitigate the effects of the 2015-2016 winter emergency and develop systems to increase disaster preparedness. This new funding is in addition to $150,000 in humanitarian assistance provided to support logistics operations and the distribution of critical relief supplies to those affected by the winter emergency, and expands ongoing disaster preparedness training with province and county-level officials. Through the U.S. Agency for International Development's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, USAID/OFDA, the U.S. government partners with Mercy Corps to work with communities to recover from the impact of the winter emergency and support the long-term sustainability of herding systems across 15 winter emergency-affected provinces. The program will improve province and county-level ability to manage risks and lessen the impact of future winter emergencies through disaster risk reduction, DRR training, and the scale-up of a national SMS, or short message-based information sharing system. This system, easily accessible by mobile phone, allows herders to access weather forecast data by equipping them with the tools to make informed decisions and develop disaster preparation strategies. Since 2011, the U.S. has provided approximately $2.5 million for DRR programs in Mongolia through USAID/OFDA, including school-based disaster planning to prepare school administrators and students for disasters, as well as incident command system training to help local officials improve disaster response operations. Winter conditions in Mongolia can be exceptionally harsh and dangerous. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Mongolia, to help the Mongolian people meet the challenge of any winter emergency.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.